Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm your host, Bruce Sugoodness. This show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, and KWTF in Santa Rosa, California. The Final Straw is sponsored by the worker owners at Firestorm Books and Cafe at 48 Karma Street in downtown Asheville, North Carolina. Firestorm provides organic coffee and milks, vegan sandwiches, homemade baked goods, radical literature, and a community calendar that can be found at www.firestormcafe.com. This week we'll be speaking with Maria, an anarchist and former student living in Montreal, Quebec, about her experiences of and a broader history of the student strikes that widened into a more social strike in Montreal and surrounding cities in Quebec, Canada. This conversation will be broadcast in two parts over the next few weeks. Archives of the show can be found at www.archive.org by searching the terms Bursts and Final Straw. And that audio should be up in the, again, in the coming weeks. So let's listen to a little more of Bauhaus off of the album Mask. This is Satori. And then we'll start up with the interview. Enjoy. One quick announcement is there's a call out for a local noise demonstration this Thursday, August the 2nd, in solidarity with the hundreds of North Carolina prisoners currently on a hunger strike in and this will be going on in Asheville, North Carolina. The call out says to meet at 4 p.m. at the Vance Monument downtown, bring drums, banners, signs, noisemakers, and friends. Spread the word. And quoting from Chapel Hill Prison Books, prisoners have expressed demands around a variety of conditions, ranging from the absence of law libraries to unsanitary and inadequate food and medical care, to the censorship of mail, to abuse by guards, and the use of solitary confinement as political intimidation. For more background information on the strike and how you can support it, check out prisonbooks.info, or you can check out last week's show. It's available on archive.org by searching Bursts Final Straw, North Carolina Hunger Strike. We're speaking with Maria, who is an American living and
living and participating in the student movements and student strikes in Montreal, Canada, here to talk a little bit about what she's experienced and give a little context for the strikes and maybe where it's going in the coming year. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So you gave a presentation yesterday at Firestorm that was very interesting, and you sort of built up a history to explain to the people who are present about why the strikes have looked the way that they have in Canada and sort of talk about the chronology of events. Do you care to go over that again?
Sure. So I'm not a historian. This is going to be a little bit brief, or briefer than it could be, but a lot of the ways that the student unions work in Quebec were inspired by French student unions, which in turn I'm sure were inspired by the Spanish Civil War and different assemblies that started happening through that. But the way it got to Quebec was there's a lot of back and forth between France and Quebec, and during the 60s a lot of French students were trying to organize in a very different way, and it started happening in Quebec as well. One of the things that people grabbed onto in Quebec is something called syndicalisme de combat, which is a type of unionism that places action in all its forms at the center of the practice of the union and affirms the primacy of mobilization. It's a unionism that's very into general strikes, very into the escalation of protest, and very into economic disruption. So in Quebec, that means that students, this happened in France, this was inspired by actions in France in 1968, but students in Quebec thought of themselves as intellectual workers at the universities, and so they created student unions that were as combative as workers' unions, that organized in a similar way to workers' unions, but were operating with students in the university. And the way those operations look is that there are general assemblies that happen on a faculty level at each school across the province in Quebec. And those general assemblies in the faculties make decisions that are relevant to those students. One of the decisions that they can do is if they are facing a fee increase, if they are facing other problems that they want to confront, they can decide to go on strike. And so the different assemblies that are part of the departments at the schools are also federated. So there is three main federations that were a part of the most recent strike in Quebec. One is called FERC, one is called FEC, and one is called ASSE. I think ASSE became a coalition for the strike, so they're most often referred to in the media as CLASS, which stands for the Coalition Large du ASSE. And ASSE is the most left student federation that exists. So ASSE's structure is based on these little general assemblies that are happening in the faculties in the schools, which then go to regional councils to make decisions at a regional level if they need to get made, and then there's also a provincial council. But the regional council and the provincial council don't make day-to-day decisions about the schools. The major decisions end up getting passed back to the general assemblies in each faculty so that students can decide at a faculty level what they want to have happen. And the way this works for strikes is that the faculties will start having strike mandates, and once enough faculties have strike mandates, the regional councils will start going on strike, and then the larger federations will be on strike. So it sort of involves like a building block kind of effect where schools will pick a certain date and then start striking from that date, and more and more and more schools will join them as they have general assemblies to decide on whether or not to strike. So students have been striking in Quebec since 1968. In 1967, the Quebec government created a cégep, and what a cégep is students graduate from high school at age 16, and then they go on to cégep, and they go to cégep from age 16 until age 19, so it's 3 years of school, and they're all free. And essentially, you can get a trade degree from a cégep, or you can get some sort of pre-university degree, and you have to have this pre-university degree in order to go on to university in Quebec. So before the 60s, a lot of Francophone students in Quebec were not going to university. The Anglophones were way overrepresented in the universities, partly because Anglophones controlled the economy in Quebec, and a lot of the universities were elite, private, Catholic-based universities. So in 67, the cégep system was created, and by 68, there was a huge demand for Francophone students to go to university, but there were no universities for them. So cégep students, 15 cégeps, went on strike through their student unions, and that strike led to the creation of the UQAM, or the University de Quebec system. I think there's 5 or 6 different universities in the University of Quebec system. There's one in Montreal, there's one in Sherbrooke, there's one in Chicoutimi, there's one in a bunch of different cities across the province. And so that was their first ever strike. It was really successful. I think it was only for 2 weeks or something really short like that. And then ever since 68, the students have been going on strike every few years, mostly against fee increases, but also in 74, for instance, they went on strike against aptitude tests, which were being used just for Francophones to keep Francophones out of certain schools. And then when they won that strike in 74, they took on the Loans and Bursaries program and managed to abolish parental contributions to loans and bursaries. They went on strike again in 1983 in solidarity with a general strike that was happening with workers in Quebec. And in 1983, they also won during that strike. There was a law that was passed that recognized student unions as legal bodies. So there you start having the student unions and their politics getting written into law in Quebec in a way that allows them to function much more legitimately than they could before. There were strikes again in 86, another strike in 88, another one in 1990. Another important one was in 1996, which is when tuition was frozen. And I believe, I don't know what the number was when tuition was frozen at that time, but the most recent large strike was in 2005. And that was the biggest strike, that was the longest strike, and that was the strike that I would say led up to the 2012 strike, because a lot of students who've been involved in the strike in 2012 were either in Cégep or in high school in 2005, were very involved in that strike as well, and remember the different things that happened during that strike and have been doing a lot during this strike to avoid some of the pitfalls that happened in 2005. So one of the things that happened in 2005 was that the government was trying to change the loans and bursary structure again and switch a lot of money that would have been a bursary into a loan. So the difference between a bursary and a loan is that when you get a bursary, you don't have to pay it back. When you get a loan, you have to pay it back. So people were, of course, outraged that they were going to start having to pay these bursaries back and decided to go on strike. And there were still the same, I believe the same three different unions, student union or student federations representing all of the different unions in Quebec, except that CLASS was called ASSE at the time. And when the students were invited to the negotiating table with the government after 7 weeks of striking, the ASSE was not invited to those negotiations because they refused to condemn certain tactics that were being used by the strikers at the time. So Frickenfeck went...
Property destruction is one of the examples that you brought up.
Yeah, economic disruption is a really huge tactic that gets used widely in the student movement during these strikes. They go on strike in order to carry out economic disruptions. So the ASSE was refusing to condemn those tactics, and the Frickenfeck decided to go to negotiations without them. And they agreed to a deal that ASSE probably wouldn't have agreed to. And so between... I think all they managed to get back was that $103 million were switched back from loans to bursaries. But there was a bunch more money that was also supposed to get switched back, or that the students were pushing to switch back, that didn't get switched back. And ASSE was counseling its members at the time to refuse to agree to this deal. So the 2005 strike ends, and in 2007 there was a failed strike where people were trying to protest tuition hikes. So the tuition went up between 2007 and 2012 from $1,600 in 2007 to $2,100 in 2012. And in 2011, it was announced that the tuition would increase again from $2,100 to $4,000 in the next 5 years. And that is what kicked off the strike that started in February 2012. The hike was announced in March of 2011, and then people immediately started mobilizing for a strike. And that looks different in different schools, but it does mean that conversations start to happen at a general assembly level in the different student unions about what they should do about these tuition hikes.
You were talking about how, I guess when I think of my time in college and I think about faculty, I think of faculty as necessarily separate from the student body and having distinctive interests in a lot of ways. They may have affinity with students because they work with the students on a regular basis and they're the people that draw them in, but the university they went to in California was very administrative, top-heavy, and was running itself a lot like a business. It had 7 vice presidents and a student population of maybe 5,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems strange to me that when I think of faculty in terms of maybe teachers that have life employment at the university, or ones who are trying to get up that ladder to be able to be employees for life for the university, for them to argue on behalf of student strikes around the increase of tuitions against the administration. So what does faculty look like in relation to students and in relation to administration in Quebecois universities?
In universities in Quebec, the faculty is very supportive, for the most part, of student strikes. Partly, I think, because a lot of them lived through strikes themselves and understand that their university system was fought for and fought for in a certain way. So I'm not exactly sure why the teachers don't teach during the strikes, but I suspect it has something to do with union mandates that don't let you cross a picket line. And one of the very important things that happened during strikes in Quebec is that the students picket their schools. They stand outside their classrooms, they talk to their classmates who are maybe trying to go to class and try and convince them not to. The same kind of thing you would see on a union picket line outside a factory or something. And so because the teachers want to be in solidarity with the students, I think a lot of their union protocol states that they can't cross a picket line because it's dangerous, or because they just refuse because that's their principles. So they don't cross the picket line, so there isn't class at a lot of the universities.
But so if ASE and FEC and FERC are, I really feel like I'm swearing.
it's to help you pronounce it better, it's FECQ.
Oh, okay.
And the other one is FEUQ.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'm still gonna.
Yeah.
Like, I need to edit it. But you were saying that those are faculty organizations, and so is it that the students present initiatives to the faculty organizations? The faculty have, or no, those are actual
FUC and FEC are student unions.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay, then I totally missed.
So FUC is one of the more moderate university student unions, and FEC represents a lot of CEGEPs. And so they're just the more moderate ones, and ASE represents both universities and CEGEPs. There is a teachers union called FNEC that's talking about maybe going on strike in August, but so far we haven't seen any teachers unions officially strike in solidarity with the students. A lot of teachers just refuse to teach.
Okay, I was just confused because it felt like what I was hearing was that the faculty was determining what the student's move would be and determining that there would be, and then the students were going out and operating. But okay, thank you. Sorry.
No problem. So the strike, one of the biggest actions that kicked off the strike was a huge demo on November 10th, 2011, which marched through downtown Montreal. There were about 20,000 people at the demo, and it ended with the paint bombing of Jean Charest's office. So for people who haven't heard this name before, Jean Charest is the premier of Quebec. Which is the American equivalent would be a governor. And his office is right in downtown Montreal. So people paint bombed his office, and then a bunch of different people occupied the principal's office at McGill University, which is one of the biggest Anglophone universities and one of the most elite Anglophone universities in Canada, not just in Quebec. So it's pretty surprising that there was an occupation at McGill. I'm not that interested in talking about McGill's role in the strike, because I don't think as a school they're that important, but this occupation was pretty important in terms of mobilizing people around the strike. And so while they were occupying the principal's office, riot cops were called onto campus, they tear gassed a bunch of people, in Montreal they don't use tear gas because it is too heavy and floats down into the metros, so they use pepper spray and CS gas. So they were gassing people and arrests. Maybe there were two arrests. I don't think there were that many arrests. The occupiers decided to leave after the cops showed up, so it didn't end that intensely. The next major event that happened during the strike was on February 17th. There is a cégep in downtown Montreal called Cégep de Vieux-Montréal, and they're one of the most radical cégeps in the city. People go to that school knowing that they will go on strike at least once during their tenure at that school. And so when I was in Montreal in 2007 and the strike kicked off, the strike that ended up failing kicked off, the strike started with an occupation of Cégep de Vieux. And I'm sure that's true in other years too. So on February 17th, students from Cégep de Vieux called a strike and occupied their school. Now the difference between Cégep de Vieux and other Cégeps is that Cégep de Vieux voted to go on unlimited general strike until free tuition. So they have a strike mandate that might last a pretty long time. They're one of the schools that are still on strike right now. That occupation ended with 37 arrests. There were huge barricades that were built outside of the school, but the cops got in anyways and arrested 37 people. By February 20th, there were 36,000 university students who were on strike, university and Cégep students who were on strike. On the 23rd of February, the Jacques Cartier Bridge was blocked, and this is something that reoccurs often during the strike. People block bridges as a form of economic disruption while they're on strike in order to pressure the province to change the demands that they end up having. On March 8th, I believe, someone named Francois Grenier gets hit in the eye at a big demo that's happening in downtown Montreal by a sound grenade. So this is a thing that the Montreal police use to try and disperse people. They shoot them out of guns, I believe, and I don't know how big they are, but they explode in the air above the demos, and you can feel the ground shake under you. They're really, really loud. So he got hit in the eye with a piece of shrapnel from one of these sound grenades and lost sight in that eye. And that night, there was a spontaneous night demo in response to this action. And one thing people are starting to learn at this time is that the police will respond how they will respond. And even if we stand in the streets with our fingers in the air saying we're staying pacifist, like we're staying passive, we're not trying to do anything violent, which was a big thing at that demo that day. There were people in the streets doing peace signs saying "En reste pacifique" in French. Even though people are doing that, the cops are still using really intense means to try and get people out of the streets. So there was a spontaneous night demo that night. In response, it was one of the first night demos of the strike. That becomes another tactic that people use a lot during this strike. On March 15th, there was the annual anti-police brutality demo, which every year in Montreal descends into a riot involving a whole lot of different people from a whole lot of different places in Montreal, and including people from out of town who come into town for the demo. In 2012, it was bigger than it had been in many, many years. I think there were about 4,000 people there. And some fun stories that I heard from that demo were that a bunch of teenagers in masks managed to get the cavalry police to turn and run. I'm not exactly sure what they were doing, but someone was telling me later about seeing the horses turn around and run, and that was pretty inspiring. On March 20th, the Champlain Bridge got blocked. So Montreal's an island. There's a whole bunch of different bridges onto the island. This is another one of those bridges. On March 22nd, 250,000 people take to the streets in downtown Montreal on the one-month anniversary of the strike. And that demo felt like a parade. One of the things that happened during that demo that got talked about a lot was that there were a small group of people in blackface pulling a huge papier-mâché head of Jean Charest, but they had anglicized his name. I forget what it was. It was like John Chabot or something. Like, it wasn't a French name anymore. And that points to an interesting historical thing about Quebec, where Quebecois people are both colonizers and colonized. So they colonized the indigenous population in Quebec and then were colonized by the English, by the British. And so there was a lot of solidarity happening in the 1960s between the Quebecois nationalist liberation movement that happened and the Black Panthers, the Black Liberation Army, a lot of like struggles around the world, third world liberation struggles around the world. The Quebecois people were really good at, or the people who were into nationalism in Quebec were very good at making those ties and trying to bring out that struggle.
So what was the relationship with the Indigenous, like the First Nations peoples in Canada?
I've been reading, because I don't know too much about Quebec history. I've been reading a little bit about the FLQ, which was the Front de Libération du Québec, which was the main armed struggle group that was existing in the 60s at the time. And they don't talk about the Indigenous population in Quebec, as far as I can tell. The last, people were also referencing something else called the, has a different name, but in Quebec it's the Patriot, like the Patriots, and that was another war that had happened between French people who were living in that region and the British. But at that time, I believe there was a lot more collaboration between the French and the native population. And after that war, a lot of native folks got pushed onto what are essentially called reserves in Canada, not reservations like they are here. But a lot of people were pushed onto reserves. A lot of people were pushed further north and told that they couldn't move around as easily as they could before. Land extraction started happening, resource extraction started happening really intensely, and it follows a similar pattern as it did in the U.S. in terms of, like, brutal suppression of any sort of Indigenous uprisings. One thing to mention in terms of race and the student movement, too, because I think another thing that happens is that a lot of people say, oh, this is, like, a white movement. But there were a lot of students of color who were involved in the movement. There's a contingent of students, I think, who were calling themselves Students of Color Montreal, who were super involved in mobilizing at different schools and had contingents that would go, anti-racist contingents that would show up at a lot of different demos. So that's something to keep in mind. One tactic that gets used a lot during strikes is something that's called a manifestation, which translates to a demo action, basically. And so those demo actions towards the end of March are getting bigger. they're radicalizing a lot versus the cops. There's more people wearing masks. The manifestations are more about blocking things. They're more about blocking the flow of capital or however you want to talk about it than they are about breaking windows and things like that. So on March 29th, there was a blockade slash occupation of the Loto Quebec building. Another popular building that people would go to was the SAQ headquarters, which is the state-run liquor organization. Around the end of March, the manifestations were happening 2, 3, 4 times a day. And at this point, 316,000 out of 420,000 students in Quebec are on strike. So a vast majority of the students are on strike. Also towards the end of March, a lot of creative demonstrations start happening. One cool one was this masquerade demo that happened, and it was creative, but it wasn't super confrontational. At the end, there was a tiny black block, and at the end of the demo, 3 anarchists were arrested and charged with conspiracy and 13 counts of mischief. That's only the first time people get conspiracy charges not even the first time that people start getting conspiracy charges during the strike. It was just the first time I had seen it happen. People are starting to get intense charges by the end of March. This was just one of the first ones I'd heard of. So another big manifestation that happens is on April 11th, the National Bank gets blockaded. The economic disruptions are still happening a lot. This National Bank blockade was one of them. There's no public call for this bank blockade, and it gets organized in crews from 12 different schools, and there was only one arrest, and they managed to block the National Bank for about an hour, I think, and stop anyone from going in or out of the building. Around that time, a lot of nighttime sabotage-type acts started happening. There were rumors of unexploded Molotov cocktails in 2 different offices. I also think it was around this time that a manifestation went to the Minister of Education, whose name is Lynn Beauchamp, went to her office, broke into her office, and trashed her office. So things are starting to get really confrontational. Around this time, injunctions start. So one of the ways that the province tries to break the strike is by allowing students to bring court actions against their schools in order to force through back-to-work, what essentially would be back-to-work legislation. Like, these injunctions are saying these schools have to be open on this date, and you can't keep them closed anymore. But all the injunctions do is create more confrontations at the schools. So schools start hiring private security companies. I don't have the numbers on me, but the numbers from some of these security apparatuses that get set up at the different universities in Montreal are really intense, including McGill, which didn't even see a huge strike happen.
So we're going to continue our conversation a recording of that conversation with Maria, an American-born anarchist who's been living for the last 6 years in Montreal, Quebec. Maria is an Anglophone and talks about her experiences of the student and expanding social strike in Montreal as the next semester comes upon the striking students there and the neighborhood assemblies move into action. So we're going to listen to a little bit of Gang of Four for a minute, and then we'll be back with another portion of this conversation with Maria. This is Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. You're listening to The Final Straw, and we will be right back.
Of my life, I opened my eyes. They say we're bankrupt capital. It fails us now. Come in, let us see the time. Capital, it fails us now. Come in, let us see the time.
Listening to Asheville Free Media, AshevilleFM.org. This is The Final Straw. I'm your host, Bursa Gunnis. Final Straw can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, and KWTF in Santa Rosa, California. So we are playing an interview recorded earlier this week after a presentation at Firestorm by Maria. And Maria is a U.S.-born anarchist and former student who went to an Anglophone university in Quebec, in the province of Quebec, in Montreal City. And Maria is speaking to us about the circumstances of the student revolt of this last year in Montreal and other portions of Quebec around austerity issues. And she is talking about the injunctions that have been imposed on students by the courts. So let's jump back into that conversation right now.
So the basic activity of that would be to stop students from forming a picket line or being able to hold a picket line, to be able to block teachers from accessing the university or interacting with, like, so if somebody, with the injunction, if a student is found to have been blocking access to the university, are they kicked off campus and not allowed back on the property so they can't blockade or what?
I don't think so. The way the injunctions were supposed to happen is that the schools would be forced to open. I think a lot of professors were being told if they didn't open the schools, they would be fired or face their unions would face intense fines, maybe. But I think all it meant, it was trying to break the pickets and it was trying to scare people, and it didn't work. So people were still on the picket lines, but I don't think they were getting higher charges from the cops or anything like that. The cops still, they would arrest a couple of people at the injunctions, but at the picket lines after the injunctions, but it didn't seem like it was a lot more people than it would have been before. And there were a lot more confrontations with riot cops at picket lines. There weren't really riot cop confrontations with picketers before that. But because of those confrontations with the riot cops, a lot of the schools stayed closed because teachers were saying it's not a safe atmosphere for us to open the school. So that bought people a few more days to keep organizing and keep their schools closed. Another thing that happened at that time, right around the injunctions, was that students released a bunch of locusts into their school that kept their school closed for a little while. Another group of students released crickets into their school, and that kept their school closed. There were tons of demos happening around this time, including nighttime ones that were just about attacking the cops and booing at pacifists. People were really angry about the injunctions, really angry about the fact that there hadn't been any response from the government at all at this point in the strike. On April 20th, there was a really key thing that happened. In Quebec, they are trying to start a new wave of resource extraction in northern Quebec, which is mostly Indigenous folks, and there's a lot of Indigenous opposition to this resource extraction plan, and it's called Plan Nord in Quebec. So on April 20th, Charest was trying to hold a conference in downtown Montreal in order to tell people about Plan Nord and invite people to apply for jobs up north. And during that conference, there was a riot that happened outside of the conference, and it was the first day that the provincial police were brought in against the strikers. So it wasn't just strikers at this demo. The other thing that was big about this demo was that it was organized by a coalition of students and strikers, or students and anarchists and people doing anti-colonial solidarity work in Montreal. So it wasn't just students who were there. There were Indigenous women who had walked from Sept-Îles, which is a town outside of Montreal in Quebec, had walked from there to Montreal for this weekend of events. And that day, people were telling me that they saw black flags everywhere. There were a lot of people in masks at that demo, and people were arriving in waves. So every time the cops tried to disperse the crowd, people would just regroup in another location. And that kept happening all day until the riot cops... People must have made a charge at the riot cops. There were rocks thrown at the cops, and there's videos online of the cops just turning and running away from people. And then the SQ gets brought in. They look like the army. Their uniforms are like brown, brownish green, and they don't have the same riot gear on that the Montreal cops wear. But that day was really big for a lot of people in terms of seeing the cops turn around and run from people for the first time ever. One interesting thing that happens right after that is that there was supposed to be a second day of demonstrations against Plan Nord, and class called off their meeting point for Saturday. So a lot of students decided not to come. One of the better arguments that I'd heard about why that happened was people arguing that these students were taking away media from the Indigenous folks who were protesting against Plan Nord, and they wanted to give people a space in the media or a space for their message to get out. But what actually ended up happening is that everyone who showed up on day two got arrested. So there were maybe 200 arrests on day two. The demo was way smaller. It was way easier for the cops, who were already angry about day one, to just kettle everyone and give them all tickets for illegal assembly. The next thing that happens is Victoriaville, I believe. Oh, no. Yeah, something that happens right after Plan Nord is that negotiations start. Not right after, but in the week after Plan Nord, I think negotiations started between the government and some of the student unions. I don't believe class was involved at the time. And so sometime during the next week, Charest came out with his offer to the students, and it was like a class, like public service announcement style thing that was saying, okay, here's the deal. I'm going to only decrease the tuition hike by $1, but I'm going to spread it out over 7 years. So if you did the math, it actually ended up being a higher hike than it would have been in 5 years. And people laughed at it intensely.
So this is at the time that he was sitting down at the negotiating table with the two other student unions that I'm not going to pronounce, and then making this announcement, but demanding that the students stop demonstrations during that time?
So in the weekend after Plan Nord, there were rumors about negotiations starting, and it became a thing where the government said they wouldn't negotiate with class unless they condemned the violence. At this point, class represents the majority of the students on strike, which is the difference between the strike in 2012 and the strike in 2005. So class does end up going to the negotiating table, but it's because Fouque and Fac give them a seat, not because the government invites them. Although they do end up issuing a statement condemning violence against people, and I believe they refused to condemn the property destruction. So the negotiations start, and that's when the night demos start. Lynn Beauchamp, the Minister of Education, comes out at the time and says, let's have a truce while we're negotiating. Let's negotiate in good faith. Don't call any demos during this negotiation. And class doesn't agree to this because they don't have the power to agree to something like that. So as soon as the negotiations start, I think it's like a day or two into the negotiations, one of the student unions who is affiliated with class calls a demo that's called Fuck the Truce, because they were pissed off that the Minister of Education would even ask them not to go into the streets during the negotiation. So this Fuck the Truce demo happened at night. It definitely had a lot of anarchists involved in the organizing. People had masks on, people were being confrontational, fighting the cops, etc. The next day, the government kicks class out of the negotiations, saying that they wouldn't keep their end of the truce. And Phuc and Phec walk out in solidarity, so as not to be put in the same position that they were in 2005, because I don't think they would survive it again. They had already lost a lot of support after 2005 because they looked like they were collaborating with the government to the detriment of the students in another union, and they didn't want to do that again. So a thing starts happening where the demos are really intense for a few days, and then as more and more and more people come into the streets, the feeling in the streets gets a little bit less confrontational. So the first few night demos, Tuesday night, Wednesday night, Thursday night of that week, were huge, really intense. A lot of people running, the cops try and disperse these demos, and then people come back together, and then they try and disperse it again, and people come back together again, until at the end of the night, there's a couple thousand, like 1,000 people maybe running around, and they were the same people who have been at the manifestations from the beginning of the strike. So it's people who have had a lot of street action together, who are slowly learning a lot of things together. And by the end of the week, though, because thousands and thousands of more people are coming into the streets because they're pissed at negotiations collapsing, this dynamic happens again where it's a lot of pacifists in the street coming up with a lot of different ways to violently try and stop people from doing property destruction. One of the things they were trying was encouraging people to everyone sit down to try and expose someone who might have just done something illegal. Another thing they would do is actually hold people in a spot until the cops could come and get them. There were fistfights that broke out. It was intense. This is all in the lead up to May 1st, which in Montreal is the day on which a huge anti-capitalist demo happens. In the past, there was only a big union demo, and then I think a couple years ago there was a split and people started organizing an explicitly anti-capitalist demo because the union was starting to try and police their actions at this union demo. So May 1st happens, and in the lead up to May 1st, everyone is thinking, oh my gosh, this is going to be huge. This is going to be bigger than the G20 in Toronto. This is going to be great. And on the day of, the demo's huge, way bigger than it had been in years past, and it also had a really huge black bloc, the biggest one I had ever seen in Montreal. And the cops react accordingly. So there was really intense cop reaction not as soon as the demo started, but almost as soon as the demo started. And it ended up with the cops shooting tons of sound grenades off over people's heads. They were using paint guns, essentially, where they would spray paint at you and then try and catch you later if you had paint on your clothes. But they were also doing this thing where they would sprint for blocks and blocks. They would sprint for like three blocks, four blocks, and then get in the cars, another group of cops would come out and start sprinting again. So there's lots and lots and lots and lots of running, and the demo gets dispersed pretty fast. And on May 4th, I believe, there is a conference that gets called in a town outside of Montreal called Victoriaville, and it's the Liberal Party meeting to discuss their strategy, and
just to pipe in, the Liberal Party is the party of the Premier, right? And Liberal in Canada, does that mean the same as it does in the US?
Yes, essentially. Although, in Quebec, it's different.
It's more like free trade, and I mean like outspokenly, and less like it's economically what we would call conservative in the US, right?
In Quebec, the main political parties that exist provincially are the Liberals and the Parti Québécois, which is a separatist party. And the Parti Québécois is the official opposition in Quebec. So the Liberals are having a conference, sort of to talk about the student strike, sort of to talk about whether or not they should hold an election, because Jean Charest has to hold an election before December of 2013, I believe. So people decide that they're going to go to Victoriaville and confront this conference that's happening. And after Victoriaville, people described the day to me as a war zone. It was all the provincial police and none of the Montreal police. And the police were using tear gas, which is way heavier than the gas that people are used to in Montreal. It hurts a lot more to breathe in. Someone got hit in the side of the head with what I think was a rubber bullet and ended up in a coma. And there's really intense videos from that day of this person bleeding out of a huge wound in the side of their head. And they had to get moved like 3 or 4 times, which you're not supposed to do for people with head injuries, because the cops kept charging people even though this person was like surrounded and people were trying to stop anyone from moving this person. Someone else lost an eye that day. It was like intense injuries all around, but also similar to Plan Nord in the fact that people were throwing rocks at the cops. And they had these little tiny fences that came up to your waist that were zip-tied together that, in the videos I've seen, looked intensely easy to just knock over. So people just knocked them over, and then it turned into a riot. One other thing that happened that day was that as people were heading back to Montreal, there were a ton of buses that had been rented to drive people to Victoriaville. And at the end of the day, the cops decided to arrest the last bus that was headed to Montreal. They pulled 100-some-odd kids off that bus and gave them all charges of participating in a riot. And they are all still facing charges. They're still going to have to go back to Victoriaville for court. They're part of the over 2,500 people who've been arrested throughout this strike.
And you had said that this bus happened to be Anglophone students for the most part?
So yeah.
There is a lot of overlap between, I mean, even if the Anglophones are in a different position, have a different relationship with the Quebecois state and all.
I mean, this strike saw students at McGill on strike for the first time ever, I believe. There were two faculties, the Faculty of Social Work and the Women's Studies Department, that went on strike. So there were picket lines at McGill. They were really intense. And there were also picket lines at Concordia. I don't think Concordia University, it's the other main Anglophone university in town, I don't think they had gone on strike before this year. And they had a ton of faculties on strike. And at different points in time, people were picketing at Concordia, which was unheard of. There was a lot of, there was a lot of organizing going back and forth between the two Anglophone universities. They were pretty good at supporting each other during the strike, as well as trying to support the Francophone universities. So yeah, it was a bus full of Anglophones that got arrested. After Victoriaville, there are still different manifestations happening every day, like still 2, 3, 4 a day. And one of the things that happens is that there's a coordinated action in which people smoke bomb the Montreal Metro. So these smoke bombs, all they are, there were videos of them online that you could see. There's smoke coming out of the metro. People aren't really panicking, but the metro system gets shut down because of the smoke. So on this coordinated day, people all shut down the metros. The metros actually shut down for a few hours that day. And there's a lot of different reactions to this across the city. It sort of falls on whether or not you support the students. A lot of people were like, I don't mind missing my bus. I don't mind missing the metro. I support the students. They need to do what they need to do. And then there were angry people all over the radio being like, oh, these stupid kids, who do they think they are? All sorts of things getting said. So another thing that starts happening after that in the media is that these people who carry out these smoke bombings are getting called terrorists. And some citizen decides to send in photos that they think might be the smoke bomb suspects. And after that, these people turn themselves in. I think there were 4 of them. And they end up facing terrorist charges. So I'm not sure if it's actual terrorist charges or if it's like leading people to believe that they are facing a terrorist attack. It might be something like that, as well as conspiracy, as well as mischief, as well as all these other charges. So they sit in jail for a really long time, like a week, and there's a noise demo at the jail while they're there. They're all being held in provincial jails, which are on the island of Montreal. So there's a really huge noise demo outside the jail for them, which was pretty cool. And then when they get out, they face really intense conditions, which is something else that's been happening to people during the strike, which I don't think has been talked about a lot. So some of the conditions they had were that they weren't allowed to be within 300 meters of a metro. Other conditions that people have been facing is not being allowed to associate with anyone who has an open file with the police. Other people have to carry around their conditions at all times. And the worst thing I've seen so far is people actually getting exiled. So there's 3 people that I know of who've been banished from the island of Montreal as part of their bail conditions. So they're not allowed to come to Montreal except for court. And these are people who've lived in Montreal, who've been organizing during the student movement. Some of them have family in Quebec, so they've moved in with their families. Some of them don't and have had to move to other provinces. It's not something that's gotten a lot of media. So
that is so intense.
Yeah.
Or like that one person you were talking about who was able to go back on one day to be able to move all of their stuff off.
Yeah. Pretty intense.
Salty. Quand ils coupent dans les programmes sociaux, qui demandent aux pauvres de travailler plus pour que les riches payent moins d'impôts, on se stache tous ensemble dans les bureaux de la loto, puis on chante des beaux slogans, on est ben belles, on est ben beau, et on reste, on reste, on reste pacifique, oh oui, on reste, on reste, on reste pacifique. Quand ils nous demandent gentiment de partir, que les gardes nous approchent un peu pour pas que la situation empire. Ils nous sifflent à l'oreille un doux avis d'éviction. Les policiers courent à l'appel pour faire leur job avec passion. Et nous, on reste, on reste, on reste pacifique. Oh oui, on reste, on reste, on reste pacifique. Quand l'ancien meurt rappelé pour nous protéger des méchants, ils tapent sur leurs boucliers, ils sont pas bien têtes avec nos slogans. Et on se met à genoux, les médias vont prendre des photos, fait qu'on fait des oreilles de lapin. On est rebelles, on est pas fins. On reste pacifique. Ah oui, on reste, on reste, on reste pacifique. Vu qu'on fait des signes d'épices, tu vois de cahier, on s'amuse, on est festif en citoyen, les citoyennes, et ils tabassent des militants, ils foutent toute leur violence, ils les arrêtent arbitrairement pour en faire passer trois jours en dedans. Et nous on reste, on reste, on reste pacifique. Oh oui, on reste, on reste, on reste pacifique. Ils nous envoient des flashbombs qui nous explosent dans la gueule. Nos amis se font péter des membres. Y'en a même un qui perd un œil. On dérange rien, de rien. On reste pacifique, on casse rien. On veut pas troubler l'opinion publique. On dérange rien, de rien. On reste pacifique, on casse rien. On veut pas troubler l'opinion publique. Quand ils flingueront un cégepien un peu trop idéaliste, on va peut-être se dire, mine de rien, qu'il serait temps qu'on réagisse.
Parce que ça reste, ça reste, ça reste des anti-flics. Oh, c'est triste, des riches et des fascistes. Parce que ça reste, ça reste, ça reste des anti-flics. Oh, c'est triste, des riches et des fascistes. C'est pas des pacifistes qui vont changer l'histoire. On crie les pavés et puis on brûle des champs.
C'est pas des pacifistes qui vont changer l'histoire. On crie les pavés et puis on brûle des champs. Parce qu'on reste, on reste, on reste en Bourgogne. Parce qu'on reste, on reste, on reste en Bourgogne. Parce que ça reste, ça reste. Ça reste des hosties de flics. Oh, c'est fils des riches et des fascistes. C'est pas des pacifistes.
Oh non,
ils vont changer l'histoire.
Rien dit.
On bitch des pavés et yeah. Puis on brûle des chars.
Parce qu'on reste, on reste, on reste en Beaucalis.
Oh oui, on reste.
Reste, on reste, on reste en Beaucalis.
We just heard Legitimate Violence, or Violence Légitime Mon Eul, a modern Quebecois folk song produced out of the student strikes of this year. The song tells the story of nonviolent protesters who were attacked by violent cops and had their minds changed about whether to embrace a diversity of tactics or not. Their nonviolence didn't change the violent nature of the police, so the songsters decided to pick up their own tactics and their own battlefield. The song references the loss of an eye by a nonviolent protester during the March 17th protests due to the fragments of a police sound grenade. Next week, we'll bring you the second part of our interview with Maria, an anarchist and former student at an Anglophone university in Montreal, Quebec, about the history of the student and social strikes of earlier this year in Montreal. There's also a call out for help in blocking the opening of the next semester at striking universities of Montreal, and next week's conversation will go into more detail about that. You can find archives of the show at www.archive.org. by searching the terms bursts and final straw.
Santé.
Quand ils coupent dans les programmes sociaux, qui demandent aux pauvres de travailler plus pour que les riches payent moins d'impôts, on se stache tous ensemble dans les bureaux de la loto, puis on chante des beaux slogans, on est ben belle, on est ben beau, et on reste, on reste, on reste pacifique, oh oui, on reste, on reste, on reste pacifique. Quand ils nous demandent gentiment de partir, que les gardes nous approchent un peu pour pas que la situation empire, ils nous sifflent à l'oreille un doux avis d'éviction, les policiers courent à l'appel pour faire leur job avec passion, et nous on reste, on reste, on reste pacifique, oh oui on reste, on reste, on reste pacifique. Quand l'ancien meurt rappelé pour nous protéger des méchants, ils tapent sur leurs boucliers, ils sont pas bien tête avec nos slogans, et on se met à genoux, les médias vont prendre des photos, fait qu'on fait des oreilles de lapin, on est rebelles, on est pas fins. On reste pacifique, ah oui on reste, on reste, on reste pacifique. Vu qu'on fait des signes d'épices, ils nous donnent du poids de cahier. On s'amuse, on est festif en citoyens et citoyennes. Et ils tabassent des militants, ils foutent toute leur violence. Ils les arrêtent arbitrairement pour en faire passer trois jours en dedans. Et nous on reste, on reste, on reste pacifique. Oh oui, on reste, on reste, on reste pacifique. Ils nous envoient des flashbombs qui nous explosent dans la gueule. Nos amis se font péter des membres. Y'en a même un qui perd un œil. On dérange rien de rien. On reste pacifique, on casse rien. On veut pas troubler l'opinion publique. On dérange rien de rien. On reste pacifique, on casse rien. On veut pas troubler l'opinion publique. Quand ils flingueront un cégepien un peu trop idéaliste, on va peut-être se dire, mine de rien, qu'il serait temps qu'on réagisse. Parce que ça reste, ça reste, ça reste des hostiles. Oh, des fils, des régimes fascistes. Parce que ça reste, ça reste.
Changer l'histoire,
rien dit.
On bitch des pavés, yeah. Et puis on brûle des champs.
Parce que on reste, on reste, on reste en beau calice.
Oh oui, on reste,
reste, on reste,
on reste en beau calice.
Asheville Free Media, AshevilleFM.org. You're listening to The Final Straw, and I'm your host, Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, and KWTF in Santa Rosa, California. The Final Straw is brought to you by the worker owners at Firestorm Books and Cafe at 48 Carmen Street in downtown Asheville, North Carolina. Firestorm provides organic coffee and milks, vegan sandwiches, homemade baked goods, radical literature, and a community calendar that can be found at www.firestormcafe.com.
La vie s'écoule, la vie s'enfuit, les jours défilent au pas de l'ennui, parti des rouges, parti des gris, nos révolutions sont trahies, parti des rouges, parti des gris, nos révolutions sont trahies, le travail tue, le travail paie, le temps s'achète au supermarché. Le temps payé ne revient plus, la jeunesse meurt de temps perdu. Le temps payé ne revient plus, la jeunesse meurt de temps perdu. Les yeux faits pour l'amour d'aimer sont le reflet d'un monde d'objets, sans rêve et sans réalité. Aux images, nous sommes condamnés, sans rêve et sans réalité. Aux images, nous sommes condamnés, les fusillés, les affamés viennent vers nous du fond du passé. Rien n'a changé, mais tout commence et va mûrir dans la violence. Rien n'a changé, mais tout commence et va mûrir dans la violence. Brûler repère de curé, ni de marchand, de policier. Au vent qui sème la tempête, se récoltent les jours de fête. Au vent qui sème la tempête, se récoltent les jours de fête. Les fusils sur nous dirigés, contre les chefs vont se retourner. Plus de dirigeants, plus d'État, pour profiter de nos combats. Plus de dirigeants, plus d'État, pour profiter de nos combats. Plus de dirigeants, plus d'État pour profiter.